Hello, America. Welcome to World Changers. I'm Jamie Osborne, and we welcome our audience on the Biz Talk Radio Network, our TV audience on Biz TV, and our digital audience on iHeartRadio. This is the show about ordinary people doing extraordinary things to change the world. And in Trenton, New Jersey, there is a 9-year-old young man. His name is Sandro. And Sandro has started a charity in his hometown that is making a difference by distributing something that we particularly need this time of year, which is coats. And so this young man came up with an idea to distribute coats to people in need. And he came up with this idea when he was 6 years old. He's 9 years old now, but when he was 6 years old, he comes up with this idea, and it has grown from there. So we welcome into World Changers Sandro Cunningham from Trenton, New Jersey. How you doing, Sandro?
Good. How are
Great.
You?
I'm fine. So let's talk a little bit about your organization called Sandro's Coat Rack. And let's go all the way back to when you were 6 years old, probably a first grader, maybe even a kindergartner at 6 years old. And you came up with the idea. How did you do that? How did you come up with the idea?
So, like, I was, like, watching the news one night, and I just saw people without coats, and then I wanted to give my coat to them, but it was way too cold, so I just started, the first year I just started, like, giving my old coats, and then the second year, my mom made this Facebook page, Sandro's Coat Rack, and then, we contact people if they needed, they had any old coats, and then me and my dad will pick them up.
Well, that's full service, and if you're picking them up. So let's talk about how it's grown. So the first year you started off, you were basically giving away your own coats. Second year, your mom helps you start some social media presence, some donations start to roll in. Now that you're a few years into it, tell me about how it's grown from those early days.
1,000 likes on my page.
Nice. How many coats, do you know?
Over 1,000.
Wow. So talk to me about, you know, obviously this is a good thing, particularly at this time of year, and you're in New Jersey, which is not exactly a warm place to be in the wintertime. So, you know, you've collected over 1,000 coats. They come in. What happens then? Is there some sort of process you go through to get them ready or sorted? Or where do you put all these coats?
We put it, like, on the coat rack. So first, like, me and my dad will, drive to the coat rack, and then we buy the hangers, and then we will, put the hangers on the coats, and then we'll hang them when I get to the coat rack.
So the coat rack is actually a physical place. You have space outside your home for this.
Yes.
Wow. Tell me about some of the people who have helped you along the way, who have caught the vision for reaching out
like
in the community.
My aunt, Robbinsville, and my school.
And how did they help you? Tell me how they helped you.
Like, by giving me, like, lots of coats.
What about the distribution side of it? So the coats come in, you get them ready, you put them on the rack, and that sort of thing. So talk to me about how you get them from that point into the hands of the people that need to receive them.
So, like, I hang them at the Trenton Soup Kitchen, and people, like, eat there. So after they're done, like, they hang out outside, so they'll see the coat rack, and they, like, most likely they'll take, like, they'll just, like, grab coats and say thank you to me, ACB.
Yeah, so tell me about some of the people who have received these coats. You've had a chance to meet some of them?
Yes.
What do they say to you?
God bless, lots of thank you, like lots of kind things to me.
And you are probably what, in fourth grade, fifth grade?
Third grade.
You're in third grade. Okay. Same age as my daughter. What do the kids at your school think about this, and have they gotten involved at all?
Yes, they got very involved. My principal and my headmaster, is just so happy of me, proud.
And where does it go from here? So tell me about your hopes and your dreams for this organization. Again, we're talking to Sandro Cunningham, and Sandro Cunningham is 9 years old, and he lives in Trenton, New Jersey. Came up with an idea when he was six to give coats away to people that needed them. That grew into something called Sandro's Coat Rack. So we're talking to Sandro. Sandro, tell me about your vision. You know, what's your dream for this organization from here?
To expand, for everyone to do it. And, the best part about it is, anyone can do it. And it's great.
When you talk about expanding, do you mean expanding in your town or expanding beyond Trenton, New Jersey?
Like expanding through the whole world, people to get involved.
Talk to me about some of the things you've learned over these past few years. You know, what has this experience of giving to others taught you?
It makes me have a very warm heart, and it's making me a better person.
In what way? How does it make you a better person?
And I'm realizing that I'm doing good things for others.
How does giving away to other people make you a better person, do you think?
How would I say it? I know that they don't have a lot, so, I just want to, just do that. So, yeah.
Now, sometimes people think that you have to be a grown-up in order to do big things. You're proving to the world that you don't. You started when you were six, now you're nine. Has what you're doing, working with the homeless there in Trenton, New Jersey, have you inspired anybody else your age to start anything or do anything?
Yes, all my friends at school, my cousins, and my brother, my soccer team, and my regular friends.
What about your parents? How have your parents helped you in this endeavor?
What?
How have your parents helped you, get this started? What role do they play?
My mom has helped me get the address and huge Facebook page, and my dad helps by buying the hangers, coming with me, driving me to houses to get the coats, and coming to hang the coats with me and set it up with me.
What's been the biggest challenge that you've had to overcome, Sandro? Have you taking this on, what's been the biggest challenge you had to overcome?
Setting up, scheduling, picking up coats.
That probably is somewhat complicated. Now, you mentioned earlier that the way that you distribute these coats to people is that you've partnered up with the homeless shelter there in in Trenton, New Jersey. And so you go and you set up this rack there. The people can come. They have a meal at the homeless shelter, and then they can go and they can select a coat off the rack. Did you approach the homeless shelter to get that set up?
Yeah. My dad, because he works at the
You're...
Trenton Police Station. And it's
Oh,
right around the
nice.
corner from my dad's work.
Okay. Well, that's awesome. Well, Sandro Cunningham of Trenton, New Jersey, 9 years old. He's been changing the world since he was six by putting coats into the hands of homeless people right in his community that need them. He told me his dream is to see that idea expand around the world. We thank you, Sandro, for being with us. We thank you
Thank
for
you.
listening. We'll be back with more world changers coming up in just a moment on the BizTalk Radio Network. Got my little boy a new bicycle recently, and he declared he had to have a new bike helmet to go along with it. And that is the subject of our next segment. Welcome back into World Changers. I'm Jamie Osborne, and the story begins back in 2015. On an April morning, there was a young lady by the name of Rachel Hall who was biking to class at Temple University when she was struck by a vehicle driven by an 18-year-old who ultimately fled the scene in a panic. Rachel was left there alone to fight for her life at the intersection of two streets, Park and Diamond. And that tragic event back in 2015 led to the creation of a company called Park and Diamond that the brother of one of the partners in the business and a friend were inspired to create. And it is a bicycle helmet company, but it isn't your run-of-the-mill bike helmet. So I want to welcome in Jordan Klein, who is one of the partners of Park and Diamond. He is joining us from New York. How you doing, Jordan?
I'm doing well, Jamie. Thanks for having me.
Great. So there's a bike accident in 2015 involving your friend's sister, which led to the creation of this company. Take me back to the early conversations you had about bike helmets and what it is you were trying to do to disrupt that space.
Sure, absolutely. So, going back to the impetus of the business, Dave and I were good friends in college. We always knew we worked together. We were both engineering students. And after Rachel's accident, we really asked ourselves, is there something we can do about this? Because, she spent about 4 months in a coma following a crash. And we really felt this responsibility to try and do something to prevent this from happening to other people. And at first, we didn't really start off saying, hey, we're going to build a product company. Our first thought was, let's start an advocacy group around, protected bike lanes and look at how we can shape alternative transportation in cities. And what we learned really quickly was that Rachel is just one of nearly 85,000 Americans that year to suffer traumatic brain injury as a result of a cycling-related crash.
85,000 in 1 year.
In 1 year.
Is that right?
Yeah,
Wow.
that's right.
85,000 in the US in 1 year suffered a traumatic injury due to a cycling incident.
Yep, absolutely. A traumatic brain
Wow.
injury specifically, which is worse than a concussion. And so, we realized that the problem was a lot bigger than what we had kind of initially thought, and that, the bicycle helmet is a really effective tool at reducing the probability of suffering a traumatic brain injury, which is more severe and carries more severe consequences than just your average concussion. And so we kind of felt that what we should do is start a company that created a product that was easy to assimilate in day-to-day life. We went out, we interviewed and observed the behavior of thousands of people, worked with some of the best psychologists in the world, had, wonderful resources with that respect to Virginia Tech, and we're able to kind of craft a product that is easy to assimilate. It collapses into the shape of a water bottle. It is the most comfortable helmet you've ever worn. It conforms really well to nearly everybody's head. And most importantly, it looks like a baseball hat. So you won't really know, and you're not going to get the stigma of wearing a traditional, you know, ugly, like racing-inspired looking helmet. So for people who are, you know, just riding to work, going to Starbucks, or they're on a scooter, or something else, it's a really compelling option to live a safer life. And that's what we're really proud that we were able to, you know, launch that coming as two college students. And, you know, it's crazy to think that it's almost been 4 years since Rachel's crash.
So you decide to invent a helmet. You're engineering students. You do your homework, and you ultimately come up with a product. But, you know, one of the problems I'm sure you figured out early on as you were looking at the scope of the issue is that bike helmets are only effective to the extent that somebody actually wears one. And it sounds like one of the things you set out to do was to make the process of wearing a bike helmet not only less bulky, but also slightly more fashionable. At what point did you come to the conclusion that that was needed in the market?
So, and that's a great question. So what we're solving for is kind of one step further than a purchase decision, right? We're solving for usage. So for us, we don't feel that we're successful until not only does somebody purchase this product, but they also use it every day. And, you know, in the case of Rachel's crash, you know, she actually owned a helmet and she was not wearing it that morning. And, you know, our concept of putting the helmet in the shape of a water bottle actually came from the Japanese manufacturing principles of Kaizen. And if you think about, and this concept of point of use, where if you think about quality in the sense of getting the intended action done every time, in a factory setting, you have to have the right tool at the point of use, right? So if you've got an M6, you know, bolt, you need an M6 wrench there. Otherwise, the wrong tool is going to be used, which can lead to quality issues. Maybe a bolt doesn't get torqued the right way or the wrong kind of paint is used. So for us, we kind of took that and said, well, hey, that's a really strong and proven method. Let's put the safety tool at the point of use. And every bicycle has a water bottle cage. And nearly every bag can carry a water bottle. And it's a form factor that we're very used to carrying around with us every day, more so than what any other helmet on the market was like. And what we found was in order to achieve this form factor, we needed to create our material, and we needed to develop a product that shares almost no processes or supply chain as any other helmet manufacturer that's currently selling right now.
Not a small task, certainly. Ultimately,
no,
you
not.
Ultimately you went to crowdfunding to launch this product, and you raised almost $1.6 million, which is not bad. I mean, that's I don't know what percentage of Indiegogo campaigns raise anywhere close to that, but you're in the very, very low single digits. What caused it to take off in crowdfunding?
So I think it speaks to kind of how we view these problems as a team, is we're absolutely obsessed with product, and we're absolutely obsessed with the consumer experience. So, you know, while we may have the ability to overcome these technical feats, such as, you know, designing the products, you know, creating our proprietary material, and doing all the supply chain stuff, at the end of the day, that's nothing but a barrier to entry for us to deliver this delightful consumer experience for somebody. And with the crowdfunding campaign.
Are you on the market now?
Yeah. So you can pre-order the product on Indiegogo right now for $89, and we're going to be, you know, shipping out those units. If you pre-order now in May, June is the time frame. There's a little bit of a lag time with how in-demand works through Indiegogo.
And very quickly, are you planning a retail strategy, or where do you go from here?
Yeah, so we're going to be doing a full-blown commercial launch, likely in Q3 of 2019, and we will have a retail strategy. I can't discuss specifically the details, but we're working on some pretty exciting partnership opportunities that will certainly be exciting and probably get a lot of PR.
All right, it's a company to watch. It's called Park and Diamond, reinventing the bike helmet, and they're changing the world in the process. Back with more on World Changers in a moment.
Blackberry, bam, lamb, whoa, Blackberry, bam, lamb, Blackberry, headed.
really been into heavy metal music. Which actually begs the question, is there such a thing as light metal music? If we have heavy metal, do we have light metal? I have no idea. Welcome back to World Changers. I'm Jamie Osborne, and I want to take you to Minnesota, to the town of Maple Grove. We're going to meet a dad there who is doing something pretty unique. It's gone somewhat viral online. His name is Richard McDeed, and Richard is the father of Mason McDeed. Mason has cerebral palsy. And this dad has been on quite a journey to help his son, which has taken him to some pretty unique things over the past couple of years. We're going to get into that in just a moment. But first, I want to welcome Richard McDeed into World Changers. How you doing, Richard?
Good afternoon, Jamie. We're doing great here.
Awesome. So let's start at the very beginning, and then we'll talk about the rather unique thing that you're doing. So your son, Mason, was diagnosed with cerebral palsy, I'm assuming, at birth or shortly thereafter, right?
Correct. He was about a year old.
Okay. And since then, he's had 132 surgeries and some other near-death illnesses. So that's been quite a journey. And really, you know, as a dad myself, something that I can only imagine having gone through. So how old is Mason now?
He is currently 23, just turned 23 in December.
Awesome. So he's 23 now. Mason is wheelchair bound, and he's fed overnight, right?
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. Okay. So you've obviously spent a lot of time together over the years, I imagine, due to the nature of the care that Mason needs. And somewhere along the way, you made an interesting discovery about your son in the process of caring for him. What was that discovery?
Oh, yes, we did. And it was about 3.5, 4 years old. I come home from work, and, you know, he's crying because a lot of pain and discomfort with digestion problems, you name it. Mama kind of was real tired of the situation, so I sent her out to do some shopping, and we were going to hang out. And the boy just wouldn't stop crying, so I kind of put him in his chair and put him in front of the TV and put Metallica Binge and Splurge on, and I walked off, and I went to do the dishes. I noticed that he quit crying a few minutes later, and I came back and he had fallen asleep probably for the first time without somebody holding him.
What did you think at that moment? I mean, did you think that was a fluke or that there was something special about the music?
You know, at that time, I didn't really think too much of it, but as time went on, I noticed that whenever Metallica was on the radio or something, that he would just kind of jump into that. I've talked to some psychologists when he was younger because I kind of thought I was brainwashing my son with my music. And they said, if it makes him happy, do it. So we kept on doing it. And I'm sure it's probably the patterns in their early music that he was able to pick up and focus on.
Were you a fan of Metallica and heavy metal in general?
Oh, sure. Yes. Yes. Mason was probably listening to Metallica long before he was born.
So did it become a bonding thing for you and your son? I mean, in those early years that you were able to find a connection through music?
Oh, yes, yes. I used to pray for a colicky baby. It sounds strange, but Mason cried for 3.5, 4 years pretty much all the time unless somebody was holding him. And that was due to his discomfort and pain from, you know, all kinds of different things going on in his body. So, yeah, we found a lot of, that made him happy. And then over the years, I've taken him to see Metallica 8 times. He's been in the front row to see them. It's made some awesome memories for us.
As a matter of fact, it says here that, according to your best estimate, you and your son have seen 1,200 metal concerts together since 2008. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We We started out with Rage Against the Machine in the Minneapolis Target Center, and we had so much fun. The crowd was so thankful and appreciative that we were there. It felt like someplace that we needed to be. And we pretty much got to the front row that night, and it's pretty much continued like that ever since.
So fast forward a little bit, and once upon a time, you came up with an idea for how to take this connection you have with your son, with Metallica, with heavy metal, and take it to the next level, and you started something, and what was that?
Well, you know, last year Mason was real sick. I'd seen him with a temperature of 107.9 for the fourth time in his life. We were in the hospital for some time, and when we were actually leaving that hospital, the doctors put me in a room and said, let's send him to a hospice. And I said, no, I'm at the best hospital on the planet, the best staff. And it took me weeks to train you guys in. I'm not going to take him somewhere else. He needs to come home. So at that point, we came home in August. And we had been kind of talking about having, you know, just a birthday party for Mason at first in December. And as time went on, we seen that that wasn't going to happen, so that was delayed. But everybody was so interested in, you know, coming and celebrating life with us that we just decided to make it in March was the next available thing. And then I did some research, and National Cerebral Palsy Awareness Month was going on in March, the day of awareness being the 25th. We thought, you know what, that's a great time, and maybe we can do something positive and good with it. As like I said, we've been going to that hospital for 20-some years. They've did most of the 132 surgeries. Mason has a lot of friends there. We talk to doctors, nurses, and staff all the time about music. It makes everything go around. And, you know, so from there, we picked that March date, then we went with it. We had the festival. 10 bands came and played. It was a lot of fun for everybody.
So called Mason Metal Fest. Okay, so
yes.
So let's just make sure the audience understands. You came up with the idea last March to actually throw a music festival of your own, right?
Yes, yes.
Had you ever done anything like that before?
Never, never. But I had you know, so much support from the local scene that it was something we needed to do. It was a fun thing. Mason likes going out listening to music. He likes meeting people. So, yeah, why not?
So 10 bands show up to play at the inaugural Mason Metal Fest. How many fans came?
Oh, there was probably just over 200.
What do you think they got out of it, other than listening to great music?
Boy, they all just love Mason. You know, they're there for that guy. They're honored to be there and play there, you know, with him. I think they got a real feeling of closeness in the scene, metal scene itself here in Minneapolis, because not only did the 10 bands that played were there, but there was a couple dozen other bands that were there in support of it. So, you know, at that point, I knew there was a lot of interest in Mason and doing something like this.
So you've really become part of a community, right?
Definitely.
Sounds like that the
part of a community,
the metal community
supportive.
Is
very supportive, so and it's always been brotherly and sisterly love. We get that same thing whenever we go to a show. It's what makes it so much fun.
Okay, so that was March 2018. It sounds like it was a hit, and so now, bigger and better, something's coming up on March 23rd of this year, right?
That is correct. When we were closing out last year's show, I was up on stage thanking everybody, and the crowd pretty much said that we need to do it again next year because it was such a good adventure for everybody. So we decided March 23rd, which is 2 days before the Awareness Day, you know, let's do this again.
What do you anticipate this year?
You know, I'm kind of telling everybody around here that our little metal party is turning into a world metal party. And it's pretty exciting.
All right. Well, we've got about a minute left. Tell me quickly what your son has taught you over these past 20-some years.
Boy, tell you what, admissions taught me a lot of patience. I was always the most patient guy when I was a younger guy, but patience is huge. He's taught me how to live life. I mean, we never know really if there is a tomorrow with that guy. So we're doing whatever we can today because that's what's important. Building memories, building life experiences with your children is very important.
All right, the event is Mason Metal Fest coming up March 23rd in Minnesota. Find it online. Thank you, Richard McDeed, for being with us. And we'll be back with more World Changers on the BizTalk Radio Network in just a moment. Back with our final segment this week on World Changers on the BizTalk Radio Network, and we're chatting with Jeff Merritt, who is with Operation We Care, based in Salisbury, Maryland. Welcome to World Changers, Jeff.
Well, thank you.
So Operation We Care has been around since 2007. Tell us briefly, what is it you do?
Well, our core mission is we send care packages to the troops deployed all over the world. And we did start in 2007 with the immediate goal of sending care packages to the troops for Christmas that year. And we received so much support from the community that we decided to continue the project. And here we are 12 years later.
So let's go back to the beginning. You said you started back in 07 with a fairly kind of one-time project to send holiday-related packages overseas to deployed troops. You're still at it, but what inspired the beginning?
Well, in our area, we realized that there wasn't really a very organized effort to do something along that line. There was small groups, you know, churches and veteran service organizations putting together small numbers of packages, and we just decided to join the parade, so to speak. And as time went on, the project grew and grew, and we've shipped over 16,000 care packages so far. So it's been a nice way to bring the community together in our area, because a lot of businesses, and individuals, groups, churches, and schools and whatnot, they've all jumped on board in one capacity or another to help us do this.
Jeff, do you or anybody in your family have a military background at all?
I do not. My father was a World War II veteran, and my older brother was a Vietnam veteran.
So, you know, being overseas, being away from home, not to mention the fact that sometimes you find yourself in a combat zone, is definitely not an easy thing. And you've been at this for a while. I suspect by now you've probably heard back from more than a few people who have received these packages. What have they told you?
Absolutely. We get feedback all the time. Just the general theme is thank you for thinking of us, and thank you for not forgetting that we're out here. The deployments are challenging on the person who's deployed, but the family as well. They have challenges here at home. Their family members not around. Somebody's got to take the kids to soccer practice. Somebody's got to get the car fixed. Somebody's got to get a home repair done that's needed, and when your family member is deployed, that's presents sometimes a bit of a challenge. We found that a lot of service members are actually not getting any mail from home for a couple of reasons. They might not have any family, or the family that they have could be economically challenged and not be able to send them anything. So when we get feedback from those folks, it's really it's somewhat heart-wrenching that they don't actually believe that somebody cares about them, and we just want to send that message that we appreciate your service and what you're doing, and we haven't forgotten about you just because you're halfway around the world.
One of the things you mentioned earlier, so again, that we're talking to Jeff Merritt with Operation We Care in Salisbury, Maryland, an organization that puts together care packages for servicemen and women overseas. One of the things you said, Jeff, is that in many ways, this project over the years has served a purpose there in your town by bringing people together, helping people rally around a cause. You know, one of the things we often see on the show is that, you know, human beings have a not only a great capacity to give, but also a great need to give, and they're looking for an outlet for that. Tell me what you've seen in your community, in terms of this project allowing people to fulfill that need they have to give.
Well, we've seen it on many levels. One of the probably the biggest compliments that somebody ever paid me during this 12 years was a lady came up to me one day at one of our events and said, "Thank you so much for doing this project. I've always wanted to do something to support our troops, but I wasn't sure what to do, and I just didn't want to send my check to an organization that I didn't know, and I don't know what they do, and I don't know where the money goes." And a lot of folks, they want to do something somewhat locally, so we do get quite a bit of local support. Working with the schools, the students get very involved in helping decorate the insides of the boxes before we pack them with messages of support and appreciation. And the schools teach them, why they're doing this and how important it is to thank somebody, even though you might not know that person. So we're just kind of trying to pass that message along, especially to the young people, that it's okay to do something for somebody, and you might not actually get something physical in return, but it definitely helps our younger people out. And
these packages
in general.
These packages just contain some pretty practical items. I mean, I'm looking at the list here: baby wipes, body wash, shampoo, cans of pasta, gum, hot chocolate packets, things like that that we might take for granted that folks might not have access to where they are. Quickly, tell me, it's one thing to collect physical items, but you have to get them there. How do you get them shipped, and where does the money come from?
Well, we ship them through the U.S. Post Office. We use their military flat rate box that's specifically designed for care packages. It's 12 inches square and 5.5 inches tall, and there's no weight limit. So we obviously try and put as much as we can in there. And
what's it cost?
$18 a box. $18 a box. And we spent $41,000 last year. It was all donated by our community.
All right. Jeff Merritt, Changing the World from Salisbury, Maryland, with Operation We Care. Thank you for being with us. And thank you for being with us this week on World Changers. We'll be back next week. I'm Jamie Osborne. God bless.